After the first two talks today, I feel a little bit intimidated and a little scared about talking, but anyway, you can view this as kind of a light segue into the party afterwards, after a hard day of heavy lifting. So what I'm going to talk about, if I can find my cursor. So what I'm going to talk about is the classification problem for measure-preserving transformations. And I'm going to give now a few slides that I think are way too elementary for this audience, but let me do it anyway. I think the idea behind this, I'm not a professional in this area, but the idea is that many deterministic dynamical... systems, is that better? Give sort of apparently random behavior on a macro scale. So even though they may be deterministic at a particle-by-particle scale, on the scale where you actually can measure them, they seem to give rather random behavior. And the question is, how to study this phenomenon? And the usual strategy, or one strategy, I don't know if it's the usual strategy, is to put an invariant probability measure on the space and study the properties, say the recurrence properties and so forth, of these probability measures. So two kind of archetypical examples. The first one are the Bernoulli shifts. This is the one we all know and love, where you're flipping a coin or rolling a dice, it might be an unfair die, infinitely often. Now, in order to make this an invertible measure-preserving transformation, you assume an infinite history, too. So the space is something like n to the z, where n is the number of heads of the dice with the appropriate product measure. And these represent the most random transformations in various ways, stated rigorously, for example, in terms of entropy. Any measure-preserving system has a Bernoulli factor that carries all of the entropy. So all of the randomness comes from a Bernoulli factor. At the other end of the scale are translations on compact groups. So these are an example of this would be an irrational rotation of the unit circle. And the compact group rotations are, in many ways, the most deterministic transformations. And so if you have a particular dynamical system that you're interested in studying, if it's isomorphic to the Bernoulli shift, in some sense, you feel justified in saying it's probabilistically random or deterministic. Getting more and more self-conscious seeing these in front of this audience. So the problem that arose is how to categorize or classify measure-preserving systems. I've given two examples of different measure-preserving transformations, and can you write a whole list of them, or can you say when they're isomorphic? And it certainly would be nice to have kind of a zoo of them so that when you're given an actual concrete dynamical system, you could say it's isomorphic to this one or isomorphic to that one. Now, this problem was attacked, I think, with the usual strategy in mathematics, which is you have a complicated object and you look at the simple building blocks and see how they're put together. And the simple building blocks for measure-preserving transformations are the ergodic measure-preserving transformations. This definition has been given several times already, so I'm just going to assume you know what this is. This slide and the next two slides are probably completely irrelevant in this audience, but let me just repeat the mantra, which originated with other people, about what constitutes a classification. So given a collection of objects and a notion of isomorphism between the objects, one wants to attach invariance to the object so that isomorphic objects get equivalent invariants, and moreover, these invariants should be somehow computable. So the strongest form of invariance, of course, would be that to each object in your class, you can find a number, and two of these objects are isomorphic, if and only if you get the same number as an invariant. But there are lots of classifications that in mathematics that aren't of that form. For example, the spectral theorem seems to count as a classification of normal operators, even though it's not, in fact, of that form. This is hard backwards over your shoulder. at least as important is the idea of what's not a classification. So you can certainly classify isomorphism for some category by using the objects themselves as the invariants and saying the invariants are equivalent if and only if they're isomorphic, so this is in some sense obviously cheating. Somewhat less obviously cheating, but against the ideology, is to just give a well-ordered list of the isomorphism classes and then to give the ordinal of the isomorphism class as the invariant to just map the object to the ordinal. And the last thing, which is cheating most of the time, is to just choose a representative for each isomorphism class. That can work if this can be done effectively, but if this can't be done effectively, then just voting for a representative for each class is not considered a classification. Okay, this definition is somehow obligatory, but I think, look, if you don't already know the definition of Braille reducibility, all of the lectures we've seen so far are inaccessible. So let me try to put this in the context that I want to talk about it, which is in a certain kind of ergodic theory. So the basic space is the space of measure-preserving transformations on the unit interval. And these, each measure-preserving transformation can be identified with a unitary operator on L2 of the unit interval. And so we can put the weak operator topology on it, on that collection of operators, and it makes it into a Polish group. Concretely, you can say what a basic open set is for this by fixing a measurable partition of the unit interval at a positive epsilon, and taking the collection of, let's see, so you're given a transformation S, a basic open neighborhood around S, are those T that behave on this partition very similarly to the way S does. So it's the collection of T such that for each element in the partition, both T and T inverse map AI the same place S does up to a factor of epsilon. So this again makes this a Polish group. And so let me specify sort of the very, very particular context that I wanted to talk about this in, namely the group. The group here is the space of measure-preserving transformations. The space, well, the ergodic measure-preserving transformations are a dense G-delta among all measure-preserving transformations, and hence is a Polish space. And the action is the action of conjugation of the measure-preserving transformations, the measure-preserving transformations acting on the ergodic transformations by conjugation. Now, by luck or otherwise, that exactly coincides with isomorphism. So, okay, I skipped a step, so let me do this carefully. Any ergodic measure-preserving transformation on that's aperiodic on a, that acts on a standard measure space is isomorphic to a transformation on the unit interval. So all of the measure-preserving transformations are represented in our space. And two transformations in our space are isomorphic just in case they're conjugate under this action. So the orbits of this Polish group action exactly correspond to isomorphism of measure-preserving transformations. Okay, so there are a number of examples of classical theorems in ergodic theory that fit very well into the kind of language that's been developed by the study of Borel equivalence relations. One example, very famous example, are the Bernoulli shifts. So two Bernoulli shifts are isomorphic just in case they have the same entropy. And a little bit of scratch work will show you that that the entropy function is Borel, in fact, rather low-level Borel. So in this case, you're Borel reducing the equivalence relation of isomorphism to equality by entropy. So this class is smooth, or what's tame? This one? Okay, so I like tame better because it's less confusing. So this is an example of a tame equivalence relation. Another rather famous example are the class of discrete spectrum transformations. So a transformation is discrete spectrum if the corresponding unitary operator, if given the corresponding unitary operator, there's a basis for L2 consisting of eigenvectors for that operator. So this class was studied, I think, originally by von Neumann. And in this case, there's a Borel function which enumerates the eigenvalues of the discrete, of the operator associated with the discrete spectrum transformation. And the Helmholtz von Neumann theorem says that two ergodic discrete spectrum transformations are isomorphic just in case they have the same sets of eigenvalues. So the set of eigenvalues is an exact classification of the discrete spectrum transformations. Now this again, this looks at first blush like a reduction again to equality. However, these eigenvalues sit on the unit circle, and the Borel function that enumerates for you the collection of eigenvalues, the sequence of eigenvalues that that Borel function enumerates depends on the way that the transformation is presented to you. So if you give me the same transformation in different disguises, you get different sequences. So in fact, I'm getting ahead of myself. So in fact, what you're getting is that you have a reduction to countable subsets of the unit circle. They all have multiplicity 1 for an ergodic transformation. So the answer is yes. Okay, so let me define one of the standard Borel equivalence relations. If you have two sequences of elements of a polar space, Z1 and Z2, you say that they're equality plus equivalent if and only if they have the same ranges. So you take the two sequences and you ask what, you know, forget about the order, do you have the same range on these? So if you think for just a second, this is a Borel equivalence relation on z to the n cross z to the n. And then the Helmholtz-von Neumann theorem can be restated as saying that isomorphism on ergodic discrete spectrum transformations is Borel reducible to the relation of equality plus on the infinite product of the circle with itself. So let me say a couple of facts about equality plus. I just remarked that isomorphism on discrete spectrum is Borel reducible to equality plus, and it's not very difficult to see the other direction as well, namely that equality plus is Borel reducible to discrete spectrum. In other words, they have the equivalent complexity by this measure. Another fact is that if you have any Borel equivalence relation with countable classes, then it's Borel reducible to equality plus. So equality plus sits above all of the countable Borel equivalence relations. Okay, so let's move now to anti-classification results, since what I really want to present is an anti-classification result. Again, in this audience, I think defining E0 is probably redundant, but let me do it anyway. Look at two infinite sequences of zeros and ones, and let's say that they're equivalent by E0, if and only if they agree from some point on. So lots of different, I mean, very well-known category arguments show that there's no Borel function from 2 to the n into a polar space X, which reduces E0 to identity on the polar space. In other words, E0 is kind of the, well, in very rigorous ways, is the first example of a non-smooth equivalence relation. Okay, so again, taking some results from the ergodic theory literature, a paper of Ornstein and Shields can be restated in this language as saying, given any fixed entropy, there's a Borel reduction from E0 to the space of K automorphisms of a particular entropy. So K automorphisms are those measure-preserving transformations which tend to forget their past. Okay, they're the forgiving ones. So the past, the present becomes independent of the past in the probabilistic sense. And Feldman modified their examples a little bit to show that you can have a Borel reduction of E0 into the ergodic transformations of zero entropy, so the completely deterministic transformations. And a corollary, which was pointed out by Feldman, I think in the, I don't remember when this paper is, but I think it was the early 70s, was that there's no Borel reduction of the collection of K automorphisms of a given entropy or the collection of zero entropy transformations to equality on a polar space. So not only, I mean, Ornstein and Shields, I think, wanted to show that entropy was not a complete invariant for K automorphisms, but Feldman pointed out that they, in fact, had shown more, namely that there was no complete invariant, complete numerical invariant for K automorphisms or even zero entropy transformations. So this is an anti-classification result in the sense that it says there's nothing like entropy can work for these transformations. On the other hand, and this is where things get a little bit interesting, the Helmholtz von Neumann theorem is one of the first theorems in a book on ergodic theory and is stated as, you know, one of the archetypical good classification theorem. So we could reason as follows. E0 has countable equivalence classes, and it's Borel reducible to equality plus. And as I put on an earlier slide, equality plus is Borel reducible to isomorphism on the discrete spectrum transformations. And therefore, E0 is Borel reducible to the discrete spectrum transformations. So if, so this is supposed to say just because E0 is reducible to isomorphism on a certain class of transformations doesn't mean that you should give up on trying to get a classification for them. Namely, perhaps it's possible to classify K automorphisms or Bernoulli transformations or whatever your favorite class, I guess Gaussian process, whatever your favorite class is, by the same kind of classification as the Helmholtz von Neumann theorem. Okay, again, I think these slides are maybe a little bit too, well, given Howard's talk, these slides are a little bit passé, but another way of classifying isomorphism is by reducing isomorphism of your supposedly complicated class, namely the class of measure-preserving transformations, to isomorphism of some kind of countable algebraic object. For example, maybe you can attach a countable group to each transformation in the class you're interested in such a way that the isomorphism for the transformations you're interested in is reduced to the question of isomorphism for the countable groups or some other kind of object. We all know examples from algebraic topology of at least partial results of this kind. So this idea, well, let me back up. Did I skip anything there? Yeah. Okay. So if you fix the category C of countable objects with isomorphism given by bijections, this is what I wanted to do. If you fix the category C of countable objects given by bijections, whoop, that didn't work. Anyway, it didn't work at all. then you can view this as an S-infinity action. So S-infinity acting on the space of algebraic objects of the kind that you're interested in. Okay, so this action is known as the logic action and has been extensively studied in what Howard called model theory. And I wanted to point out that in ergodic theory, the Helmholtz von Neumann theorem has exactly this form, namely you're associating to a measure-preserving transformation a countable object, and the countable object can be viewed as a countable structure in a certain language, and isomorphism between the associated countable structures is exactly the relation of isomorphism between the measure-preserving transformations. So let me ask these questions now in this language. K can isomorphism on the ergodic transformations be reduced to a logic action, or can this be done generically? What about k-automorphisms? What about, again, choose your favorite classification here. Now, Greg Horth developed a technique. He has a massive study of S-infinity actions and then developed a technique, a combinatorial technique, of showing that a particular group action is not reducible to an S-infinity action. So now let me give this definition. It's not quite as complicated as it looks. So take G to be a Polish group acting continuously on a Polish space X. Then the action is said to be turbulent if and only if, first of all, every orbit is dense, every orbit is meager, and finally, whenever you have two elements of X and an open neighborhood in X and an open neighborhood in G, with X, little x, belonging to the open neighborhood V and the identity belonging to the open neighborhood in U, let me just say this in English. We have our group G up here, and we have a small neighborhood of the identity here. And we have a little point X here, and a neighborhood, what did I call them? I guess U is here, and V is here. And a Y out here, we can find a Y0, which is equivalent to Y, where you can get arbitrarily close to Y0 by taking very small steps, namely you're acting by elements of this neighborhood of the identity, so you can get arbitrarily close to Y without leaving the neighborhood V. Okay, so the bad guy hands you a neighborhood W of Y0, and you have to get from X within that neighborhood of Y0 by taking small steps, namely by acting by elements of the group G that belong to the neighborhood of the identity. And I hope that's what's written there, with any luck. Okay, so here's Y. You're finding an equivalent element Y0, and you find a sequence which converges to Y0. Well, it doesn't converge. It has Y0 as a limit point. And all that amounts to is that you can get within any neighborhood of Y0 with a finite number of steps. So this is the notion of turbulence. Oops. Oh, I didn't put Greg's theorem there. Okay, so what Horth said, this is supposed to be a big slide. Let me apologize to Greg if he's in the audience. So Horth proved that if you have a turbulent action, then it's not reducible to any S-infinity action. And he proved the converse for Borel equivalence relations, namely, if you have a Borel equivalence relation which is not reducible to an S-infinity action, then there's a turbulent action which is reducible to it. So this is supposed to say that this rather complicated-looking property is really intrinsic to, well, to the equivalence relation not being an S-infinity action, or not having this property is intrinsic to being an S-infinity action, or something like that. So this very much captures what S-infinity actions are. So the new theorem I'm going to talk about today is that the conjugacy action of the measure-preserving transformations on the ergodic measure-preserving transformations is turbulent. Okay. In particular, if you have a co-meager subset of the ergodic measure-preserving transformations, then you can't reduce isomorphism on that co-meager set to an S-infinity action. In other words, there's no way, if you take a relatively large set of measure-preserving transformations, there's no way of reducing isomorphism of that collection of measure-preserving transformations to algebraic isomorphism on countable objects. There's no Helmholtz-von-Neumann theorem. There's nothing like a Helmholtz-von-Neumann theorem for a co-meager set of the measure-preserving transformations. Okay, did I succeed in at least stating a theorem coherently? Okay, so this proof, especially in contrast to what we've seen earlier today, is kind of light, and I'll do what I can to actually give the proof. So instead of this complicated condition, we're going to give something which is at least superficially less complicated. So the claim is that whenever you have a neighborhood of the identity in the measure-preserving transformations and an ergodic transformation T, so let me draw the picture of what we have to do here. So our group up here is the group of measure-preserving transformations, and down here we have the ergodic measure-preserving transformations. And we're taking a neighborhood V, which is determined by a finite number of sets and centered on some transformation T. And we have a neighborhood of the identity up here. And an ergodic transformation S, which lies inside V. Let me draw V bigger. So here's our transformation T. Here's the neighborhood V of T, S. Then we can walk from T to S, staying inside V, using baby steps, using transformations that come from T. Okay, so this is what we're going to show. So what we're going to use is the following theorem. Let T be an ergodic measure-preserving transformation, then the collection of T prime that have the same orbits of T almost everywhere forms a dense set. Now, until very recently, I thought this was off-the-shelf technology, but I think there's actually something to verify here, which we have. So what this means is that I'm supposed to walk within a neighborhood W of S here from T, and I instead can walk from T to a T prime in this neighborhood of W as long as I walk inside a small enough neighborhood of T prime, where T prime is chosen to have exactly the same orbits as T does. So this reduces the question to the simpler combinatorial problem of walking from T to an S where the orbits of S are the same as the orbits of T. So let me just say what we really show to prove this. What we really show to prove this is that if you have two partitions of the unit interval given by Ci and Di, such that the measure of Ci is equal to the measure of Di, and whenever you have an ergodic T, you can find a T prime that has the same orbits almost everywhere as T, and T prime sends Ci to Di. So somehow you move every partition around every which way by transformations that have the same orbits of T. And the proof of this goes by rearranging Rockland powers on which the Ci's and the Di's have approximately the same distributions. And it's sort of an easier version of it I'll give for a something similar to it, not necessarily easier, I'll give later on. Okay, so now, in fact, what we're really going to prove is that if you hand me an epsilon and a delta, which are positive, and an S and T, which are ergodic, where S and T have the same orbits almost everywhere, then you can find a sequence of elements Gi in the group of measure-preserving transformations such that the Gi's, the total mass of the set of X that the Gi's move has some small measure, less than epsilon, and such that if you look at the sequence defined by starting at T and walking using the Gi's, then the Ti's, the set of X such that Ti of X is either equal to T of X or S of X, has measure less than delta. And finally, that the last thing has total measure, also has total measure less than delta. Okay. So let's see that this suffices. First of all, what are we given? The data we're given is a U. We're given a transformation T and a neighborhood V of T given by a partition. And we're given an S and a small neighborhood W of S. And we can assume without loss of generality that S and T have the same orbits. So now we're in a position to apply the claim. Now, this neighborhood of the identity, of course, can be taken to be the neighborhood of 1 by some other partition, B1 up to BK. I'm overusing epsilon here. Let's call this rho, and let's call this sigma. And the neighborhood consists of those group elements that fix B1 up to BK except for sigma measure. Well, look, if you take epsilon to be much less than sigma, or maybe epsilon even equal to sigma, if you have a transformation such that the total measure moved is less than sigma, then certainly each BK is moved by less than sigma. So this first condition is quite easy. Now, the second condition, we want that the sequence defined by taking, remember, Ti plus 1 is Gi Ti. Thank you. So Ti plus 1 is Gi Ti. We want to know that these sequence of Ti's stays inside this interval V. Okay, well, why is that? Well, S belongs to the interval V, and each Ti agrees with T or S, except for some set of negligible measure, some set of measure less than delta. So each Ti along the way, if this is Ti, and you hand me an Aj, most of Ti agrees with T or S, and T and S agree almost all the mass. So this shows that they're equal. And finally, if this neighborhood is centered at S and we take the delta to be less than rho, we get this last example by the same kind of thing. Okay. Can I turn that off again now? Okay, so a basic tool in doing this construction is Röcklin's lemma. And this says the following: if you take an ergodic transformation, an ergodic measure-preserving transformation T, and a natural number n and an epsilon, you can find a set B, which is the base of the Röcklin tower. So this set B looks like this, such that if you take B and TB up to T to the n minus 1, of B. These are all disjoint, so T just maps up the tower. Okay, sorry. T maps up the tower, and moreover, you've exhausted your space except for some set of trivial measure over here. So the union of these levels is at least measure 1 minus epsilon. This is just a way of organizing the orbits of the transformation. Okay, so this is called an epsilon Röcklin tower. Sorry to be so difficult. Can't help it. Okay, so the proof goes in three steps. The first step is to choose a natural number m so large that the collection of x for which Sx and S inverse of x is not contained in the 2m plus 1 iterate has measure less than delta over 3. Okay? So given x, if we ask, is Sx a member of this m orbit, because S and T have the same orbits, for m large enough, Sx will be in there. And so we can take an m so large that almost your whole space is the property that both Sx and S inverse of x belongs to a very large portion of your orbit. And let's call L0 the points that we lose control of at that stage, and we can make L0 they have small measure. Okay, the second step is to build a Rockland tower that is an n delta over 3 tower, if you want. So the set that we're going to lose at this stage, the stuff off the Rockland tower, has negligible measure. And n is so large that we can forget about, remember, we have the first number we fix, is m, which is the partial orbit of t that we're going to look at. N is so large that if we have a Rockland tower of height m, n, so here's b, here's the bottom level, here's t to the n minus 1 of b, if we forget about the top m levels and the bottom m levels, we still haven't lost very much measure. Okay, now the bottom level has measure at most, one over n, and we're throwing away 2m levels. So if we forget about the top m levels and the bottom m levels, then we've thrown away 2m over n, at most 2m over n measure, and if we take n to be so large that that's trivial, then we can not only forget about the set L0, where the partial orbit doesn't contain the forward and backwards images of S, but we can forget about the top M and the bottom M levels, as well as the kind of reservoir left over by Rockland's level, by Rockland Tower. So if we let L0 be the ones we lost at the first stage because S and S inverse aren't contained in the partial orbit, and L1 to be these top and bottom N levels, M levels, and L2 to be the Rockland reservoir, then the total number of points we've lost is measure less than delta. And we're just going to give up on those points. Okay, so take an element y in the base of the tower. And let's look, so let's take an element y down here in the base of the tower. I'll do it this time. Which one is it? Okay. If we take a y in the base of the tower and look at the x's in the fiber over y that aren't in the top m levels or the bottom m levels, then we know that if this is x, we know that s of x and s inverse of x are somewhere on this tower. They may drop down into these levels, but they're somewhere on this tower, except for the set that we've already lost. Okay. Now, S organizes, if we take a graph and connect two points, on this tower, just in case S moves one to the next, we get a directed graph, and that directed graph has connected components that look like this. You know, they're just a tower. And if we just make those connected components linear, we just put one before the other, what we get is a cyclic permutation of the tower over Y that agrees with S where S is defined. So we can choose a cyclic permutation sigma y of 0 up to n minus 1 such that s of t to the i y equals s of t to the j. If s of t to the i y equals t to the j y, then sigma y of I is equal to j. So sigma just records for you where it's defined how s is permuting that. All right, now for each permutation sigma, you can ask, for each y, if you can look at the permutation, you can turn that around, and for each sigma, you can ask which y's give you that permutation, and that's a measurable set. So what we've done is we've broken. Now I'm going to ask for an eraser. Let me draw the bottom level bigger here. So what we've done is we've broken this bottom level B. We've broken this bottom level B into sets depending on which permutation you're going to use. So here's sigma 1, sigma 2, and so on. Now, on each of the B sigmas, we can just simply rearrange the levels according to an element which makes the permutation sigma conjugate to the usual permutation that just sends 0 to 1, 0 to 2, and so on. So we can just rearrange these levels by mapping these up. Okay, so choose at each for each sigma a permutation tau sigma, which conjugates. I'm going to go back there in a second. Doc, sorry. Which conjugates the interval from 0 to n minus 1, conjugates the cyclic permutations ending 0 to 1, 1 to 2, and so forth, to give you sigma. And you can define u sigma by just sending each level vertically along the level according to what this permutation does. Okay, well, what does this do? I mean, u sigma now. I should have a little remote or something. U sigma, then, if we apply U sigma, then, except for the set that we've lost, U sigma conjugated with T gives us F on this column. Okay. Now, look, the bases of these are disjoint, so it doesn't matter what order we put the u sigmas on, we're done except for one thing, which is that u sigma may move too much measure. But that's not a problem. Look, we just choose sets down here at the very base such that the measure of the base is 1 over m. I'll just go to the appropriate slide here. Don't get up. So if we just divide each base, b sigma here, corresponding to this transformation, into pieces such that they have size less than epsilon over n, and take our transformations gi to be the ones that move these pieces, permute these pieces around, then we get the last requirement so that we can just apply these in order. Okay, well, I gave this talk once on the blackboard, and it would take about an hour and 15 minutes. Now I'm doing it with slides, and I seem to finish in 45, so enjoy the party.